So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our panel. We're going to start with Jabin White, Director of Strategic Content at Wolters Kluwer Health. We'll move on to Darrell Gunter and then Chris Spiguel.
Good morning. My name is Jabin White, as Ed said. I'm going to talk about metadata from a publisher's perspective. In preparing these slides, there was definitely some redundancy between Ed and myself. Hopefully we've stamped all that out, but where there is redundancy still, that's because we're really trying to hammer home a point. So you'll probably hear some things from me that you already heard from Ed, but we really want to make those points. My goal is to sort of set a baseline of from a publisher's perspective and then turn it over to two much smarter and more technical folks who are going to tell you some pretty exciting things about what can be done with metadata and the like. A lot of familiar faces in the room. Those of you who know me know I'm a pretty simple guy, some might say simpleton, so I will try to take things down a notch. I think metadata is oftentimes shrouded in, you know, FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and I don't think there's a very good reason for that. So I'm going to hopefully define some things that I think are relatively unclear for no apparent reason, and then talk about what that means from a publisher's perspective. So a little bit about what is metadata. Ed already covered that very well, and why should publishers care? What kind of impact that has on publishers and their processes, and then two brief case studies at the end to show, you know, metadata in action. So reading a definition of metadata, I say, is like trying to resolve disputes with my kids. You get into this circular logic. Metadata is data about data. That, to me, is one of the most useless explanations I think I've ever heard in my life. So I asked my son, why did you hit your sister? And he said, well, she looked at me funny. And then I asked my sister, his sister, why did you hit your brother? Because he looked at and I said, well, don't do it again. And I'm walking away. And they're like, but if he looks at me funny again, I'm going to hit him again. And it's shampoo, rinse, repeat. And at the end, it doesn't really sort of move the ball down the field. So what does that mean, data about data? And it's, trust me, it's out there in the world as the sort of go-to definition of metadata. So we'll try to peel back the onion a little bit and say what does that exactly mean. We might think of metadata as something new, but it really is not, and I'll give a few examples of that. So why should publishers care about this stuff? Why is everyone attending a session today about metadata? Well, it used to be when, you know, publishers made books and print products, it was pretty easy. You know, books basically have one use model. You know, you print pages and people read them. And there weren't a whole lot of different things you could do with the content once it's on a page. You can walk out onto Fleet Street here and say, how do you read a book? And you're going to get a pretty good answer from people. The same cannot be said for digital content. There are use models ad infinitum, and they can vary depending on a lot of different things. So, you know, because books were so simple, and I don't mean to be insulting to print books, but, you know, there was sort of one use model. They had a beginning, they had an end, there was a physical presence of a book, and it usually sold for one price. Now, I say mostly because there were some discounts and things like that, but really, you could say, this is a book, and it cost $19.95. And that was a very sort of easy thing to deal with. Today, computers are often communicating with one another as much as they are with people. And this is, you know, in a nutshell, that's why metadata is becoming more important. Metadata helps drive, you know, business-to-business relationships, which we'll talk about. It enhances your ability to have a relationship with your customer or customers. And I put, you know, B2 blank because I don't know what other possibilities your specific business could have. Metadata can enable things that you know about your organization and your content that you couldn't do before. And each of those use cases varies depending on what your content and your sort of use models. So Ed made this point, I think, pretty well, but the quality of the metadata is what, you know, think of it as a tool to give you a bigger voice in what happens to your content. I like that definition a lot better than data about data. So building on Ed's example of the house, you know, something closer to publishing, you've got a digital asset, you know, an image. And this is the sort of classic metadata example. You can say all sorts of things about the image that you can then use to do things with, to hopefully make more money from the use of that image. What file format is it? How big is it? Who took the picture? Who owns it? What are some of the copyright implications? When was it created? All these types of things are information about a particular image. And that can be repeated across an entire organization, all of your images, all of the video, all of the textual files, and that's all metadata. If a publisher's goal, and I think we all sort of agree that it is to disseminate content to the widest possible audience, metadata is absolutely critical and becoming more so. Ed introduced me, and it's a new role for me. I'm on week 3 of this job as Director of Strategic Content at Wolters Kluwer Health. It should speak volumes that I consider, you know, probably more than half of my job is worrying about content that will never be published. It's metadata. It's, you know, helping shepherd content that will see the light of day in either print or electronic form. And it's metadata. It's data about that data. And that's how important it is to publishing today. So again, with books you had that one use model, but with metadata and digital publishing you can drive lots of different relationships. A couple of examples of those are obviously relationships with your customers. That's sort of the big duh. Everyone knows about that. Relationships with aggregators. If you're sending digital files to an aggregator, that company is going to act on metadata, and it makes the relationship not only easier, but sometimes possible. Sometimes the relationship can't exist without metadata. Here's all the information about this file, and here's what you, aggregator, can do with it. That communication, the language of that communication, is all metadata. It can help on the open web, but one sort of note here, you know, Google does not use meta keywords. It uses other things, and we can do a whole session on the Google search algorithms, but Google does not reference meta keywords on web pages. I have an example of, you know, you can, anybody can view source on a web page and you can see the meta keywords, and it's basically that web page's publisher's, take on what's important about that page. So if I have a web page about baseball, I'm going to have meta keywords, baseball, and, you know, all the things that relate to baseball. Everyone has seen those, I'm sure. One thing that, you know, a lot of companies have tried to do is sort of game the search engines, and this is done with a lot of adult keywords. I know Ed was telling me a lot of times when he searches for his porn, he comes up with sites that have nothing to do with the search at hand. So was that a private conversation? I'm sorry. I apologize. There have actually been a couple of lawsuits. Playboy has sued two companies successfully over, you know, I have a web page about, again, baseball, but in the meta keywords I put Playboy. That's illegal. The judge ruled in two cases that that's misrepresenting the content of the web page. However, Playboy lost a lawsuit when one of the former playmates was using meta keywords Playboy, and they said that was fair and appropriate use. So this stuff is important. A lot of times, and I hate to say it, but a lot of times you look at the porn sites as really on the leading edge, and I see smirks and stuff, but they're really pushing a lot of this stuff, and they make a lot of money. So a lot of times you look at what they're doing, and they fight over keywords like crazy. Meta keywords are very important to them. I mentioned this a little bit about with the aggregators, but it's the same thing. Technology partners or developers. If you're sending content to a developer, they're going to act on meta tags and metadata in your content. It's going to make their job a lot easier in the creation of electronic products. Systems wherein the content is a value add. And I apologize, all my examples are going to be from STM publishing, but, you know, you think of electronic health records or CPOE systems where content is not the main thing. It's a value add to something that already exists. They're going to act on metadata to include content at the appropriate place within the workflow. And then finally, metadata drives multiple outputs. You know, you can do a lot more with acting on the data in terms of, you know, you can drive print product, you can extract things for a specific output acting on the metadata, and we'll see examples of that. So this is, I referenced this, you can view source, but this is, you know, my company's homepage, and you can see there's meta name, and that's a description of the website for people, and that's going to come up when, you know, you do a search and you see the little introductory paragraph of what that web page is going to be when you go to it. So that's for human beings. And then it has keywords for search engines. This is machines talking to machines. And these are all the sort of different types of words that you can use. A lot of people put, you know, typing or spelling derivations in there to make sure that you're going to not lose those people if they misspell the search term that you're looking for. So there's really two different types of metadata. There's the classifying, you know, sorting type of metadata, and those examples are all on the left. I told you this was not new. ISBN is metadata. It's information about content. The Dewey Decimal System is metadata. All these things on the left, up to and including, you know, DOI, is metadata. And then on the right, there are some, like I said, all my examples are from STM, but contextual things that describe what the content is. And that goes for, you know, ICD-9 and 10 codes, mesh headings, SNOMED CT, nursing codes, and then drugs. And one of my case studies is about drugs. Drugs are all about codes. And, you know, how they're classified and how they're displayed is all based on codes. It's a really sort of over simplification, but the left is old and the right is new, with the exception of DOIs, which are belong in the new camp. So there's nothing wrong with the old camp, but, you know, the descriptive stuff is what's driving. Everyone's probably heard of the semantic web and things like that, and that's really the more modern way of using metadata. So semantic metadata is one of the critical pieces of this. Using a controlled vocabulary, either an existing standard one or one that you do on your own, you can use semantic indexing to drive a lot of really good things about content. And again, this falls under the umbrella of metadata. Semantic indexing can drive more precise searching, contextually based connections. The confusion between two terms that are supposed to be the same thing. You know, if somebody searches for hypertension, they should get results that say high blood pressure, and vice versa. Those are the sort of classic two medical examples, but those are there's a lot of examples of those. And then filling of content gaps. That's an underutilized one. If you have everything tagged in a controlled vocabulary, you can sort of look across your content and see, well, there's a concept that exists in this taxonomy that we don't have enough content in, and can fill in that way. That's a use of metadata, but that has some implications for publishers as well, which we'll get to. So how much of an impact this stuff has on publishers really depends on how you answer those questions, some of which Ed posed and some of which I posed, which is, you know, what am I going to get in return for this? You know, don't just do metadata for metadata's sake. But more and more, this is becoming a how much do I do versus if I do it. But once you make that decision, publishers who say, okay, I get it, and I want to embrace metadata, you basically have two options. There is the metadata within the workflow. Make it a critical part of your organization, and it's as important, if not more, than the methods and workflows that you use to create content. This obviously requires a pretty big commitment and has a pretty wide impact on an organization, but it also has a bigger upside. It requires thinking and potentially re-engineering of authoring tools, workflows, enterprise-level content management systems, all to maintain that metadata. If you're going to invest putting it in the content, it should be maintained and acted upon intelligently. So a combination of good metadata in the workflow and some creativity with your product development folks can pay big dividends. I've got a slide about that later. This stuff in the workflow allows for participation from authors. And I'm an old XML guy, an HTML guy, and I always say, well, it's best done by the authors. And then when the laughter dies down, you say, well, okay, if you can't get the authors to do it. This is the exact same thing. Ideally, it's done by the authors. But knowing that, you know, there's the ideal and then there's the reality, there is subject matter expertise out there, either outsourced or you can have it in-house, that can then act upon the data and insert value. Option two is completely outside the workflow. This is if your organization is not very change tolerant, but you still want to reap the rewards. Like a lot of things, you know, a lesser commitment means a lower upside. But it definitely has benefit in that you can have the content created, you can drive a print product, and if the content is in its final form, whatever the heck that means, you can then insert the metadata. Very low disruption of workflows and processes. And then you can keep the subject matter experts as a sort of separate offshoot in the workflow. And again, that's something that is easily outsourced. And there are people today, companies today that do that. Or you can choose to take an approach that Darrell and Chris are going to talk about, which is coming at it from the software side. So not all of this has to be done with manual tagging. Ed made reference to the fact that we might have a fist fight, and I want to be clear that, you know, Chris, Darrell, and I did not disagree on this stuff. There are very good cases that can be made for appropriate use of Temis, of Collexis, of, I don't know what the heck I'm advocating for, but, you know, there's sort of the manual tagging side of things as well. So there is no one-size-fits-all solution, but if you have to pick one, I'm right. There's also the concept of active versus passive metadata. Active metadata is the name is very descriptive. I'm going to actively insert metadata in the content, and I'm going to put all the processes in place that support that. So that is the publisher intentionally associating markup with pieces of content, whether textual or graphical or video or what have you. Often using a controlled vocabulary, hopefully using a controlled vocabulary. This is sort of an umbrella term for semantic indexing as well. And it can also be machine-based. You can use scripting to accomplish some of this. But it will always be better done by human beings. There's also passive metadata, which is, metadata created based on how the content is used. If you pull 3,700 images and use them for an anatomy textbook, guess what? That becomes part of the metadata. And this image was used for this publication, can then follow with it. So you can come back later and say, oh, okay, if it was good enough for this publication and that publication did well, I'm going to reuse it over here. So that's an example of passive metadata that can, it's a pretty low impact. Once the systems are set up to capture it, it can travel with objects. And then there's the inheritance of properties. If it's it's a paragraph in a section about this, then it's going to have these properties. So the use of active metadata, as I said, usually has a bigger impact. You have to rethink authoring tools and allow for the capture. I said a little bit of this already. Outsourcing options are available for this. You definitely have to rethink content management and allow for the preservation and sort of intelligent use of these tags. And again, like a lot of things, how deep you go depends on what's the payoff going to be. So semantic indexing drives a tremendous amount of features, but there's also a cost of entry into that. And again, I said if you decide to go active metadata, controlled vocabulary is about a must. I won't go that far. I said I would try to reduce some of the FUD around metadata, and these are just a couple of slides that my take on buzzwords and acronyms that are floating out there that bother the heck out of me that I think are too unclear. A couple things. Ontology. There's all sorts of words, and I should actually start with the bottom note. The caveat is these two terms, ontology and taxonomy, are so brutally misused that the actual definition has become unimportant. It's like content management in 2000. Everyone was saying, we do content management. Well, sometimes they meant document management, sometimes they meant digital asset management, sometimes they meant web content management. Nobody knew what the heck anyone was talking about after a while. The same thing is sort of going on here with ontology and taxonomies. There's also a couple of standards. PRISM is a standard. You can see the definition there. And it started out with a way of sort of standardizing some of this metadata stuff. If we say that metadata is data about data and go do, you're going to have the Wild West. And PRISM is sort of a way of reining in some of that and saying, okay, these are the things that we mean. Dublin Core is a very appropriate name. They had a conference in Dublin, Ohio in 1995 with a bunch of librarians, and they said, look, let's agree on what's going to be important in the metadata. There's so much misunderstanding about Dublin Core, but it really is simple. It's basically 15 elements, and you can use these however you have to in your content. You can use some of them, you can use all of them, but it's basically saying, when it comes to tagging your object with metadata, use these things as buckets and fill them in. And if you do that, you're Dublin Core compliant, and that means a lot if you're a librarian or if you're somebody acting on that data. PRISM is an implementation of Dublin Core. It uses those 15 elements to describe things. RDF, I'm sure everyone has heard of, but it's basically an XML implementation that lets you richly describe the data between web pages. It is metadata. Everyone knows what links are. You know, I can have a term and I've got a hyperlink, it goes somewhere else. RDF introduces a concept called triplets, which is I describe what the link target is, I describe what the link source is, and then I describe the nature of the relationship. So instead of having my name and then a link to some page and you're like, why am I going here with this link? With triplets and using RDF, you actually describe both sides of a bidirectional link, and then you describe why you put that link there in the first place. It sounds like a really kind of abstract concept, but it's great when you're dealing with a whole bunch of data, and it's a very good use of metadata. We talked about, I mentioned the semantic web. That is coming. I believe that my kids will work on this, so it's a few years off still. There's the friend of a friend project, which is a great name. It's basically trying to use metadata to capture people's social networking identities and then make that standardized, which is a really neat thing. So I can see, if I'm online, I can see what my friends are interested in, and if that interest is something that's similar to mine, and it's all sort of a way of controlling that. Again, all metadata. And then Sparkle is a way of sort of querying metadata in RDF. So real quickly, just to wrap up, a couple of case studies. I mentioned I worked on a drug reference. Drugs and drug information is all about metadata. There are there's pieces of content that you print, you know, the old package inserts, but then all the stuff that goes in between and describes it, it's potentially more important sometimes than the actual content itself, especially when it comes to what happens with that content. Examples of the metadata that was stored, you know, a lot of codes, all the drug interaction information. You would not want to read a drug name and say, by the way, it interacts badly with these, you know, 1,700 drugs. But that's information that can go in the metadata that can then be acted upon when you do an interaction search. Drug classifications, I say this is redundant because sometimes it is output in print or in electronic form. Sometimes you do want to see what classifications a drug belongs to. And then formulary information. You would never want to see, you know, the drug name heparin, and by the way, it's part of the Johns Hopkins formulary. But that would be something that would be stored in metadata, rightly. And then FDA approval date as well, which could also be potentially redundant. So there were basically on this drug reference four editors that spent as much time working on metadata as they did on the content themselves. And everything that was imported and exported from the database was done by acting on the metadata, either through intelligent queries like the one at the very bottom, you know, show me all the drugs in this class that were approved before this date. All that is acting on the metadata. If you tried to do that search with, a full text search, it would be a very long and drawn out process. And then finally, the last case study, and again, I'm on week three of this job, so it's a little hubris of me to show an example from Wolters Kluwer because I had nothing to do with it. But there's a suite of products. It's actually thousands of topics called the 5-Minute Clinical Consult. It's a big title for WK. Sometimes they're printed. Sometimes they're sent to web or handheld. But how they get updated, how they get output, how they are printed, or whether or not they are printed, is all driven by metadata. And there's an entire system that has been built to support this family of products, all driven by metadata. The subject matters of each topic are all sometimes many to one relationships. If it's a particular disease, does it belong in the pediatric section, the general medicine section, sometimes both? All those things are housed in the metadata, and then you see other things as well. So just a couple of screenshots to show you what the heck I'm talking about. That's the sort of main page of the topic, and this is the publication. It is all these topics. There's about a little more than 4,000 topics, and that's just a part of the A section there. And that's a typical topic. Very structured, these are the heads that they all have and share. So then the authoring tool is web-based. You can see this is from the instructions, the authors page. It's got instructions about how to insert metadata. You can insert, a PubMed link that is, there's some intelligence that helps you how to do that. You can link to other documents or add drug information. There's all these types of things that will never appear in the content itself, but that support metadata. Again, the ID values for each topic are assigned during XML conversion and loaded into the tool. So that's metadata, but that's an example of passive metadata. The authors never have to see that. The authors do things like, does this apply to both male and female? Is it female only, male only? That is driven by metadata. The authors' names are all fielded. Ed said sometimes metadata is, you know, actually content itself. The authors' names are all fielded, so they become metadata. And then the biggest one of all is the authors pick primary and secondary categories. These things are critically important when it comes to, you know, how much stuff do we have in pediatrics? How much stuff do we have in sports medicine? All these kinds of sort of intelligence about the data are housed in the metadata. Ed made a very good point. This is the last two slides here about having a metadata strategy. I strongly concur. It's got to be driven by a business case, and you've got to have a reason for investing in the tools and the processes and the workflow changes around metadata. Knowing your organization is critical. If you can tolerate change and, you know, throwing a hand grenade in the middle of a workflow and building the capabilities of doing this, by all means, go right ahead. That doesn't have to be the way it's done these days. Show me someone who says they have the universal approach to metadata, and I'll show you. Liar maybe is a little bit strong, but, you know, there is no one-size-fits-all solution is the word. And then one last point, a little bit of understanding by people who were charged with product development, who were thinking about the ways that customers use and interact with the data. A little bit of understanding about metadata by those folks can go a long way towards creating new and different products. And basically, if the content can benefit from metadata in the creation of new products, then that should raise a red flag and justify investing in tools that change the workflow and things like that. Thank you very much.